Good morning, listeners. My name is Tracy Melissa Wheaton, and I'm the Program Specialist and Technology Specialist at InSource. I'm here with Dr. Mitchell Yell, who is a Professor of Special Education and the Fred and Frances Lester Chair of Teacher Education at the University of South Carolina. Dr. Yell has written 4 books, 90 articles that have been published in top peer-reviewed journals in his field. He's written over 21 chapters and 16 encyclopedia entries. His primary area of research and writing is on legal issues in special education and IEP development. Dr. Yell has been at the University of South Carolina for 20 years. Prior to coming to USC, he was a public school and special education teacher in Minnesota for 16 years. Dr. Yell, good morning. It's a great pleasure to have you with us today.
Good morning. It's a great pleasure to be with you.
Well, I know that we had asked parents to get with InSource about what some of their specific questions are with regard to special education law. It, you know, regardless of all the information that's currently out there for parent centers like ours to try and disseminate and help parents understand, there's always these sort of gray areas that we don't always know how to answer. And so what we did was put it out there for parents. You know, let us know what your concerns are, and we'll field these questions with Dr. Yell and see what he can come up with. So the questions you'll be receiving today are all questions that parents have posed.
Okay.
The first question that we have, what are the qualifications required for being an aide to a child that has cerebral palsy? Last year, the school chose the aides for my daughter, and I was not happy. They were recess aides and had absolutely no knowledge of how to work with children with cerebral palsy. Do I not have some latitude legally to help choose the aides for my daughter? Her IEP states that she is to be given a one-on-one aide all day for school, so one would think that I would be able to have some say in who is selected and what kind of training they receive. Dr. Yell?
Well, you really don't have any choice in the aide. But what you do have choice in is in your child's IEP, you can request as a related service that your aides receive training, receive proper training. That can be included as a related service in the IEP.
Okay, and this is just a question from me as a further follow-up there. That's something that can't be written in the notes section if it's going to be legally binding, correct? It needs to go directly in the IEP, and it's got to be worded in such a way that, you know, child will have appropriately trained aid, something of that nature?
Yes, that's correct. If you need a service, you really need to make certain that it is put into the IEP and discussed at the IEP meeting, but written into the IEP.
Okay, very good. And I would suppose then a parent could review the IEP when they get the draft back or the completed version that has yet to be signed. They can review it to make sure that it is where it was discussed that it was going to be.
Yes, and just to add to that a little bit, training is certainly a related service that can be added. I mean, you can request and discuss training for an aide. You could discuss having training for your teacher, for your child's teacher also.
Very good. Thank you. Next question. Within the context of a manifestation determination, what sort of data is required to determine whether or not a student's questionable behavior was in fact caused as a result of his or her disability?
Well, that, of course, a manifestation determination is kind of a difficult thing to get your hands around. Essentially, it should require, ideally, there would be a functional behavioral assessment conducted. The individuals involved would be interviewed. There'd be new sources of information rather than relying on older, possibly outdated sources of information in making the decision. But the way the law is stated, of course, it has to be a real, for a behavior to be manifestation, it has to be a very direct, very directly correlated to behavior, to their disability, to the misbehavior. And I would say probably just requesting a functional behavioral assessment would be a good idea.
Very good. Thank you. Next question. Is there any instance where an entity outside of the school can screen a student's data without a parent's consent?
Yes, there is what is called directory information, and this is not so much under the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act as it is under the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, or FERPA. And although students' educational data is confidential and can only be shared with persons who have a legitimate reason to know without a parent's consent, there is a clause that says certain directory information can be shared, but that is not specific educational information. That would be like the grade levels, people in grade levels, and issues like that. But in order for actual student educational data from tests, from IEPs to be shared, the people who have a legitimate reason to know, which would be teachers involved with the students, administrators, possibly counselors, related service providers, that doesn't require consent. However, if a person does not have a legitimate reason to access that student's important and confidential data, parent consent is required.
Thank you. Next question. If an item is described in the notes of an IEP, but again, and this kind of gets back partially to our first question, but appears nowhere else within said document, is it still something that must be followed? I have a parent who wants her daughter working on basic additional and subtraction skills, and that's in the notes. However, in the IEP, it states functional math, dash, student will be working on identifying money, how to use it, etc. So how specific does the parent need to be with respect to helping to word the strategy or the method implemented to meet a given goal?
Well, you know, one thing, of course, a parent could do in that case is just contact the teacher and talk to them about that. But it would be a good idea to have it in the goal. If that's a specific area you want worked on, it would be something to discuss. But I would think in most cases that could be handled with the teacher and the parent themselves. They wouldn't necessarily have to call a new IEP meeting. I would say in the original IEP, it would have probably been a good idea to include that under an addition and subtraction goal. But if the IEP is already written, what the parent and the teacher could do is they could add a goal without reconvening the entire IEP meeting or the IEP team. Number one, contact the teacher, tell them that, you know, that you want your child working on basic addition and subtraction facts. And I'm certain that would be taken care of in that way. But if you also want on the goal, you could ask the teacher if you could add that as a goal, you and the teacher working together, and just amend it to the IEP.
Next question. Why is it so difficult to get an IEP for a child with ADHD? I have a daughter in kindergarten who is very bright and who does well with learning, but who fails with social interaction. She also has very disruptive behaviors in the classroom to the extent that she's been asked to leave school and has been suspended. I am phoned by the principal almost weekly, and yet the best they will do is a 504 plan. I feel that she needs more support.
What I would say there is much as I mentioned it to a previous question, it would be really important to try and address those issues up front. If the IEP team had discussed an interpreter and were going to put it in, that would be a time to discuss the need for an interpreter who is fluent in American Sign Language. And that could be a discussion point and put right into the IEP, in which case, of course, then that service would have to be delivered. If that's not the case, again, the parent can always request another IEP meeting. And if I can just say one other thing, another option the parent always has, sounds like in this perhaps the school district is not in agreement totally. One option the parent always has is to ask for mediation, or if they cannot reach an agreement, or file a state complaint. That's a underutilized method of addressing problems in the IEP is, I think, the staying complaint process.
Or why are her current circumstances not enough to qualify her for an IEP?
Well, I would think they probably are. I mean, clearly, oftentimes students with ADHD will be served under 504 because there's not a particular category for attention deficit students with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Although they can be served under other categories, such as other health impaired, learning disabilities, emotional disabilities. And one of the things the parent could do is request an IEP and have that, serving the child with an IEP in special education under the category of other health impaired. Or if the behavior is extremely disruptive, perhaps emotional and behavioral disorders. But once the child is served under the IEP or under IDEA, of course, there are many more rights available. Also, I noticed in one of the things you said in the question had to do with suspension. Now, children with disabilities have essentially the same due process rights when it comes to suspension as do children in special education. So if suspension is going in excess of 10 days, that could also be a violation of 504. But I would say request an IEP meeting and discuss including your child in the category of other health impaired. Because clearly, although you mentioned she's very bright and does well with learning, the special education essentially says a child has to have a disability under the IDEA. Well, ADHD isn't under the IDEA, but it can be served in these other categories I talked about. And also the child has to have a need for special services, essentially either an academic achievement, which your child obviously does not have, or in functional behavior.
So if she cannot be, if she's not having any learning concerns, you're saying that under the category of functional behavior, if she is, that should be something considered when asking for an IEP.
Absolutely. When IDEA was reauthorized in 2004 under the Individuals with Disabilities Education Improvement Act, present levels of performance was, that name was changed to present levels of academic achievement and functional performance. And there's two bars that a child has to meet to be served in special ed. One, they have to have a disability covered under the IDEA. As I said, ADHD is not under the IDEA, but it can be served under other health impaired, learning disabilities, or emotional disabilities. The second thing is they have to have a need for special education services. Clearly, the child we're talking about doesn't have an academic need, but they do have a functional need. So that would be the avenue to accept a child ADHD and use one of those other categories, such as other health impaired, and the need would be a functional need as opposed to an academic need.
Very good. Thank you for explaining that. Next question. Can a parent opt for a more restrictive environment for a child in school if that child is being bullied and otherwise made fun of in general education classes? It's an interesting question.
That's a very interesting question. Actually, it's becoming more and more an issue in special ed cases. And courts have held a number of situations that bullying that's not addressed, that a school is aware of bullying of a child with disabilities and it's not addressed, that can be a denial of a FAPE, of a free appropriate public education. So that needs to be addressed. And one of the things the parent might want to do there is request an IEP meeting to discuss the bullying. If a child is being bullied, in terms of special education law, that can, like I said, be a denial of a free appropriate public education.
Thank you. That is a great question, and that was a really good answer. Next question. What does it take for a parent to be heard when requesting that their special needs child be held back in a grade? And why do the schools refuse to hold children back?
Well, that's a difficult issue. Many school districts have policies and they certainly don't like to hold students back. But that's certainly a topic that can be discussed at an IEP meeting. And if the parent is really very concerned about that and believes a child may need to be held back, that's certainly fodder for the discussion. Call an IEP, request an IEP meeting, discuss it if it's something the schools really don't like to do. And a lot of schools don't like to. You could ask the special education director be there and discuss that. But the problem is in a lot of schools don't like to do that. But and there is research that does show that holding back students in a grade may not be that successful in most instances. But if the parent is very concerned about that, that needs to be discussed at the IEP meeting. If there is one, and so the parent always has the right to call for an IEP meeting. So that's where they need to address it.
Thank you for answering that question. And I'm struck by this the longer that I do this job, is it's a little known fact that parents have the right, if they disagree with the outcomes of an IEP meeting, that they have the right to go ahead and call and ask for either mediation or to file a complaint. And, it certainly isn't the place to start, but it's a couple more tools in their toolbox. And I always recommend that if a parent feels they're not being taken seriously after a meeting or that their concerns aren't being heard, that they consider, following those routes.
Yes, and I think it's very important also that parent training associations and parent training resource centers, advocacy centers, many advocacy centers, will have educational programs for parents. They'll have people who will act as advocates in IEP meetings. And I think that's a real important that can be very, very useful avenue for a parent to pursue. I know we have one very strong advocacy organization in South Carolina called the South Carolina Autism Society that has peer parent mentors that they mentor. Parents request a mentor. Mentors will help them through the IEP process, actually go to IEP meetings with them. And I think that's a great resource.
Agreed. I think no one can empathize with the needs of a parent of a child with special needs the way another parent of a child with special needs can. And they've certainly been through it. We find here in utilizing similar yeah. types of mentors that they have just provided, an invaluable level of sort of depth and knowledge and personal experience that, even we, as we're overwhelmed providing advocacy, just can't manage for them. So, yeah, I agree with you. Any concluding thoughts on some of the topics yes. that we've discussed today, or on special education law in general? Anything that you would have parents or our listeners know that maybe we haven't covered?
Well, I would say be knowledgeable about the process and really use your parent training associations. And I think they're just such an excellent assistance for parents. I mean, it can be very intimidating for a parent to go into an IEP meeting, especially when they're in disagreement and there's a number of people and it's just an intimidating situation. So I think resources that are provided through different advocacy organizations are so important. I also do think that in the next few years, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act will be reauthorized again. And I think rights, I'm certain, will have some interesting changes coming in the law. So that's another reason for ensuring that parents use advocacy organizations to keep abreast of what the developments in the law are.
Interesting. Dr. Yell, again, thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciate you joining us.
Well, thank you for asking me. I'd be like doing this, and I'd be very happy to do it again if you'd like.
We'll get back to you when those changes come in the law.
Okay.
Thanks again.
Thank you for listening to the InSource podcast. The views expressed on this podcast are the views of the person being interviewed and not necessarily the views of InSource.